Chapter 10 Cratology. Building 213 next to the Washington Navy Yard is a seven-story concrete complex that consists of three cube-like buildings covering two city blocks. Surrounded by a cyclone fence topped with triple rows of barbed wire, the complex, at 1st and M Streets southeast in Washington, is manned around the clock. What few windows the building have are tinted brown so outsiders cannot see in. Nearly 2,000 people go in and out every 24 hours. This is the National Photographic Interpretation Center, NPIC, a component of the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology that analyzes and interprets images. The center was started by Arthur C. Lundahl, a brilliant former Navy man and University of Chicago graduate who went to work for the CIA in 1953 when the agency was located in dusty, temporary buildings at 23rd Street and Constitution Avenue Northwest. Lundahl became chief of the Photographic Interpretation Center. In 1961, the division became NPIC. The CIA runs the center, but all the military intelligence services participate in it. For many years, it was located on the four top floors of the Stewart Motor Company, a huge factory-like brick building at 5th and K Streets Northwest in Washington. At first, the photo interpreters used nothing more than magnifying glasses and measuring devices to help them analyze aerial photographs. Slowly, they built up a library so they could compare one frame with a similar frame taken a year or two earlier, allowing them to pinpoint changes. "You look at a place and then what it was like last year or yesterday," Lundahl said. "It's like looking at a movie. The frames are further apart, but you can infer much more of the intentions by seeing the changes on the ground than by doing it one frame at a time." To bring out small differences in elevation, NPIC had CIA reconnaissance pilots take pictures separated by dozens of yards of the same area. By using stereo techniques, NPIC could use the exaggerated dimensionality of the pictures. For example, depressions in the grass from tires or people walking would leap out of a photograph when viewed this way. For the most part, NPIC concentrated on strategic intelligence and research that could be used to predict long-range trends. Tactical intelligence, which could be used to pinpoint targets for bombing missions, was left to the military. Whether it happened on Earth, in the air, or in the sea, NPIC learned to interpret and make sense of it. For example, photo interpreters looking at Virginia could tell that the people were meat-eaters because they could see hog pens and cattle. They could pick out the industrial plants where rail lines enter. They could draw a floor plan of each house based on outside clues. The kitchen is under the exhaust vent on the roof. There is a sewer vent over the bathroom. The living room has a chimney. Everything else in the house is bedrooms. Based on the growth of the cemeteries, photo interpreters could tell how many people died each year. From that, they could estimate the area's population. Computers added another tool to the photo interpreter's bag of tricks. As William E. Burroughs described them in his book Deep Black, the computers inside Building 213 were routinely being used to correct for distortions made by the satellite's imaging sensors and by atmospheric effects, sharpen out-of-focus images, build multicolored single images out of several pictures taken in different spectral bands to make certain patterns more obvious, change the amount of contrast between the objects under scrutiny and their backgrounds, extract particular features while diminishing or eliminating their backgrounds altogether, enhance shadows, suppress glint from reflections of the sun, and a great deal more. The computers could even analyze the smoke coming from smokestacks and determine, through spectral analysis, what was being burned. With infrared, which senses heat, analysts could not only see inside buildings, they could tell that a plane, for example, had been on a runway hours after it had left. The most critical need when NPIC was started in 1961 was to determine what missiles the Soviets had. It was NPIC that counted Soviet missiles during the missile gap debate, demonstrating that there was no gap at all. NPIC went on to use the same techniques to uncover the Soviet missiles being sent to Cuba. By then, NPIC knew what the erectors and transporters for the missiles looked like and what kind of crates they were shipped in. Even though the missiles were covered with canvas before being deployed, their length, shape, and width gave them away. NPIC analysts developed expertise in interpreting missile packaging. "There was a science of cratology," Lundahl said. "Also, they had shelters for steamrollers and other heavy equipment, so we had shelterology. Cuban troops slept in one kind of tent, Soviet troops in another kind. The Soviets used a standard deployment pattern. The cable lines ran in a certain way. There had to be a place for fuel storage. The minute we saw that, we knew what it was, R. Jack Smith, who was assigned to the Directorate of Intelligence at the time, said. Based on its previous experience in analyzing missile deployment in the Soviet Union, NPIC was able to tell President Kennedy how long it would take for the missiles in Cuba to become operational. This was supplemented with information from the manuals to the missiles provided by Colonel Oleg Penkovsky, the Soviet intelligence officer who began spying for the British in early 1962. Finally, on October 16, 1962, Lundahl presented Kennedy with photographs that convinced him that the missiles really were there. On that basis, Kennedy confronted Khrushchev and, by threatening retaliatory strikes, got him to remove them. Politically, the Cuban Missile Crisis had demonstrated that overhead reconnaissance, and satellite reconnaissance in particular, was a stabilizing factor because it greatly reduced the element of surprise and, in the process, lessened the chance of a dangerous, all-out preemptive attack for fear that the enemy was getting ready to do the same thing, Burroughs wrote in Deep Black. The satellites substituted imagery for imagination and provided a realistic look at what the opposition had and did not have. We gave our leaders answers, gave real substance to our national estimate, gave enlightenment when there had been darkness, Lundahl said. I think we avoided nuclear war a couple of times, particularly in Cuba when people knew exactly what the facts were. We provided a basis for the Strategic Arms Limitations Treaty, which for years they referred to as confirmation by national technical means of collection. Generally, the whole litany of our national intelligence was moved steadily into a technical arena, where the scope and speed and detail of information kept track of world events. People from the president on down became accustomed to this kind of service. NPIC helped to predict that the Soviets would launch an Earth satellite before the U.S., and that the Chinese communists would detonate an atomic bomb. With its help, the CIA also predicted the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, the India-Pakistan War, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. NPIC ensured that the Soviets were complying with arms limitation agreements. In 1990, it was NPIC that first pinpointed the movement of Iraqi troops toward Kuwait 3 weeks before the invasion. The center's photo interpreters pointed out that the Iraqi troops had months of supplies of fuel, far more than would be taken on a training exercise. Once the war started, NPIC pinpointed biological and nuclear facilities. NPIC routinely forecasts harvests, predicts natural disasters, pinpoints marijuana fields, and estimates the size of oil spills and forest fires. Some of the information is provided to other government agencies, such as the Commerce Department, to help them plan relief programs. By tracking the size of wheat and other critical harvests, the Agriculture Department can better estimate what prices will be like on the world market. A camera can take a picture of anything, and ipso facto you are involved in everything, whether it be economics or crops or biological warfare or missiles or submarines or missile testing, Lundahl said. Anything at all that man does on the face of the earth that is exposed to the sky, you get images that, if interpreted correctly, can tell you a tremendous amount of information. Today, nearly all of the CIA's satellites provide data in real time, meaning that a battlefield commander can see enemy movements while they are happening. By combining images from magnetic, heat, radar, and visual-based images, NPIC can zero in on particular questions. This is particularly helpful when the Soviet Union or other countries try to camouflage their facilities. It's a game between hiders and seekers, Lundahl said. The art of camouflage, decoys, deception is very well developed. Yet for all the wonders of science, no technology can divine an adversary's intentions. Photo interpretation, when well done, can give you an excellent view of an enemy's capability, Lundahl said. You can't get his intentions. You can get some intentions. If you see a furnace is being moved or a railroad track is being torn up, you can tell it is being moved, or cement is being poured. These developments, in turn, may mean the enemy is planning to build a missile silo, for example. But the facility could initially be made to look like a factory. Nor can photos convey long-range plans and intentions. Nothing will replace a good human spy, Roland Inlow, a former chairman of Comirex, said. In the area of human spying, too, the Directorate of Science and Technology plays a major role through its super-secret Office of Technical Service. Chapter 11. James Bond. In windowless offices within CIA headquarters, the Office of Technical Service, OTS, within the Directorate of Science and Technology, devises state-of-the-art devices for bugging rooms, tapping phones, sending covert messages, and photographing documents. Several hundred CIA employees, including engineers, cabinet makers, woodworkers, leather workers, and physicists, plant bugs or create secret compartments in everything from kitchen cutting boards to felt-tip pens. Over the years, to conceal its devices, the office has used car oil filters, videotape cassettes, false bottoms of toolboxes, toy trains, batteries, cigarette lighters, basket covers, teddy bears, chess sets, paintings, wallets, statues, hot plates, and toilet kits. For an agent of the CIA in such areas as Cuba or the Soviet Union, these tools of the spy trade are critical for maintaining security and carrying out his mission. An agent must photograph documents, deliver messages to his case officer, receive cash, and arrange meetings. Of greatest importance, he must have a way to signal in an emergency that he needs to leave, or exfiltrate, the country. The CIA usually provides agents with several alternative escape plans. One plan requires the use of a signaling device that sends a coded message to an embassy or other listening post. Sometimes the simplest methods are best. In Moscow or Havana, a window left open at night or a shade drawn halfway may signal a meeting or a drop at a prearranged site. In such cases, no high-tech methods are necessary. Instead of a custom-fitted wig, an operations officer may slick down his hair and wear glasses. "I might walk out of the embassy at the end of the day with a suit and tie and long hair and my briefcase," a former operations officer said. "I might go into the bathroom of a hotel and take off my coat and tie, put them in a briefcase, put on a sports shirt, wet my hair and slick it back, and walk out with maybe my raincoat draped over the briefcase. If I am arrested, I don't have any spy gear. If you use spy gear, you are in trouble. If you are arrested and they peel your face off, you have a lot of explaining to do." Bugging and wiretaps also have their limits. "You can get too much data," a former officer assigned to the Office of Technical Service said. "The case officer thinks, I'll just put a bug in the room and then I'll know everything. It's not that easy. Number one, you've got to be able to make sure one can do that. Number two, you've got to make an installation, and you've got to worry about the other side finding it. Then you have to have a listening post where it comes in. You have to have someone changing the tapes. Then you have to translate and transcribe the tapes. Once a month, something worthwhile comes out. But often you are inundated with a lot of marginal data that requires a lot of sifting. Is it worth it? The answer is frequently no. One guy in a key location can often tell you more in 5 minutes than all of the taping." But for most jobs, the Office of Technical Service provides invaluable aids, the most advanced spy equipment in the world. Many of the items have cost millions of dollars to develop. Sometimes the devices are developed within OTS, and sometimes by outside contractors cleared for security. "There's merit in both approaches," a former OTS officer said. "The practical way would be to do both. If it's way beyond the state of the art, for security reasons, it might be done in-house. The problem is you don't have the production capability in-house. If you want 135 of them, you don't want to tie down people soldering. If you want one, you can put two guys in a room for 2 years. But if you want a big order, you might do them outside." One of the most commonly used items supplied by OTS is disguises. Before going overseas, some operations officers are fitted with several. In rare cases when CIA officers have to break into a house or embassy, why take a chance that a witness might identify them? Or if a case officer is about to try to recruit an agent, he might wear a light disguise, a wig and glasses, so that if a potential recruit turns down the offer, he cannot readily identify the case officer who made it. A disguise is more likely to be used in a denied area, such as the Soviet Union, or if the potential recruit is a terrorist or drug dealer. The material used for masks is of high-tech design that permits the skin to breathe. The agency has a disguise capability that no one can touch, a former OTS officer said. Because of electronic listening devices designed by the OTS, a number of Soviet bloc embassies in foreign countries have been penetrated. The OTS supplies the installers, called audio operations officers, who are often assisted by officers from the local stations. One installer was an extremely supple Japanese-American who stood 4 feet 9 inches tall and weighed just 80 pounds. He wormed his way into air ducts in order to plant bugging devices. The installers are guys willing to climb a fence in the middle of the night. If they're caught, they're in deep shit. They might spend 15 hours on a job, a former OTS officer said. It is not a simple thing to do. They may need to drill a hole in a wall and put in something that will transmit for years. If the target sees a hole, he tends to get suspicious. They may have to replaster the wall and match foreign paint that is 6 years old. It's risky business, the former officer said. It's hard to explain why you're in the building in the middle of the night with a bag. I'm a plumber. You're in the wrong room. The toilet is over there. To make listening devices difficult to detect, OTS will sometimes transmit on the same wavelengths as a local radio or television station. You mask the signal, a former officer said. There are ways to snuggle up to a standard radio signal. 101.4 plays oldies. You might snuggle up to that. So my signal is hidden by that. That would be a typical way. You hide it or burst it so it's on the air a short period. Today you have a low probability of intercept, LPI, the former officer said. The name of the game today is spread spectrum, which operates on a variety of frequencies, so the signal is difficult to find. OTS operates its own secret printing plant at CIA headquarters with type for most foreign languages. It can produce old or foreign paper and foreign driver's licenses and birth certificates. If you have a printing press, you can make anything you want, a former OTS officer said, but there are rules on what can be done. CIA regulations prohibit the agency from producing false U.S. documents such as passports, birth certificates, driver's licenses, or college degrees. However, the agency can print less important, non-official documents, such as library cards or membership cards. It also can request a blank driver's license or college certificate from the issuing authority, and if approved, imprint its own data on it. You go to a high authority and say, I'm from the CIA, a former officer said. You show credentials and you tell him what you want. Perhaps you deal with the director of motor vehicles, appealing to his patriotic spirit to provide an authentic blank license to help establish the identity of an agent or officer in an operation. Or you go to a university for a college degree. Any chance of a blank? If you want, I'll tell you generally how we'll use it and who it is issued to. It may not be his real name, but you can be assured it's for a good cause in the service of your country. One college administrator will say, take a hike. Another will give 3 with tight controls. Another will say, 3 dozen, it's my country, good luck to you. The military freely provides identification cards to the CIA, but the State Department rarely does. Obtaining a U.S. passport in an alias requires high-level approvals and is only infrequently done. If the documents are needed to establish a light legend, meaning a superficial cover story, no steps are taken to make sure that if someone calls the college or motor vehicle department, the name on the document will be registered. But if a more sensitive operation is involved, the CIA will try to elicit the cooperation of the issuing authority in backstopping the document. In those cases, if someone calls the motor vehicle department, he will be told that a license has been issued to the individual whose name the CIA has imprinted on the blank driver's license. Similarly, a college president may agree to make sure someone is listed as having graduated from the college, usually for only a month or two while the operation is going on. If your agent is going to be subjected to any kind of scrutiny, you want a real address. In the old days, we would say 32 Prince Avenue. There wasn't any. Today, you'd better make sure it's real. Pick a large apartment building, but don't put down the apartment number, a former OTS officer said. CIA assets or agents are often used to backstop an identity. An inquirer calls the asset to verify alleged employment. The asset says, he's been here 12 years and he's one of our best employees. In fact, the asset wouldn't know him if he walked in the door. Because of the change in attitude since the church committee hearings and the generally tighter approach to corporate responsibilities, companies are less willing than before to help the CIA establish cover for agents. What you want to do most is to handle your documents and your agreements carefully, a former OTS officer said. In obtaining cooperation from companies, the CIA today tries to warn of every conceivable consequence, including possible loss of business if the word gets out that the company has helped the agency, becoming known as an agency front. CIA Director William Casey tried to enlist the support of more U.S. companies in helping the CIA to establish at least temporary cover. He was largely successful. But even before the Church Committee hearings, few companies wanted to commit themselves to the kind of complex relationships required to establish long-term cover for CIA officers. In forging foreign documents, anything goes. OTS may produce fake passports of other countries, fake foreign birth certificates, and fake foreign driver's licenses. Since CIA officers generally do not want to be identified as Americans, these are the documents most commonly used. Early in CIA history, OTS made such items as dog in heat, the essence of a chemical that sexually attracts male dogs. As conceived, the chemical would be sprayed on the doorsteps of the homes of Communist Party members overseas, so they would be besieged all night by yelping dogs. It was never used, but a stink bomb known as Who Me, meant to be thrown into Communist Party meetings, was. Every 5 or 6 years at someone's retirement party, someone brings it in a vial. I just happened to find it. It's the last one in existence. Great guffaws and laughter. That kind of crap hasn't been used in 30 years, a former OTS officer said. I don't think any serious officer feels, by and large, that that sort of thing is worth the effort. The OTS has tried everything, from extrasensory perception to psychics, to try to penetrate KGB tradecraft, such as where the KGB locates dead drops. What we wanted to know was, where do the Soviets leave their dead drops in Washington? A former OTS officer said. The answer was a very large oak tree at a busy intersection in northwest Washington, meaning the answers were too general. Anytime you got to specifics, that happened. We lost interest in it. Not the least of OTS's duties is fashioning mementos or gags for CIA officers who are retiring. When William Baker left the CIA as Director of the Office of Public Affairs to become an FBI Assistant Director over the Criminal Division, OTS supplied a Sherlock Holmes outfit that William Webster gave him at his going-away party. For all the James Bond devices and the billion-dollar satellites, the CIA would be helpless if it did not have a way of bringing all the information together and making sense of it. That is the job of the Directorate of Intelligence. Part 3. The Directorate of Intelligence. Chapter 12. Mirror Imaging. Special National Intelligence Estimate, December 4, 1941. For the past 2 weeks, Japan has been warning its diplomats that war may be imminent. Interception of Japanese diplomatic traffic indicates the message "East Wind Rain" has been repeated on a regular basis. Intelligence officials believe this code means Japan has made a decision to go to war in the near future. In addition, there have been these other signs that Japan may be preparing to go to war. On November 22nd, Foreign Minister Togo informed Ambassador Nomura that negotiations between Japan and the United States must be settled by November 29th, because after that, things are going automatically to happen. For the past 2 weeks, the Japanese have been padding their radio messages with garbled or old messages to make decoding more difficult. 3 days ago, the Japanese Imperial Navy changed its ship call signs. This is an unprecedented change since they had just been changed. Normally, they are switched every 6 months. 2 days ago, the Japanese Foreign Ministry ordered its consulate in 6 cities, including Washington, to destroy all but the most important codes, ciphers, and classified material. 3 days ago, the U.S. became unable to locate previously tracked Japanese submarines. Scattered, unconfirmed reports indicate naval air units in southern Japan have been practicing simulated torpedo attacks against ships there. These warning signs justify immediate, extraordinary steps, including placing the Pacific commands on immediate alert. If the CIA had been around at the time, this is what the agency's Directorate of Intelligence might have handed President Roosevelt 3 days before Japanese forces attacked Pearl Harbor. As Dr. Harold P. Ford, a former acting chairman of the CIA's National Intelligence Council, has pointed out in his book Estimate of Intelligence, all of the facts listed above were known to the U.S. government 3 days before the disastrous attack on Pearl Harbor. If such an intelligence estimate had been presented to the president, defensive action would almost certainly have been taken. But the government had no central agency for marshaling all the information, making sense of it, and presenting strategic assessments to the president. The only existing intelligence agencies at the time were those operated by the military, and they were often considered dumping grounds for the least qualified military personnel. Each of the services was at the other's throats, and fiefdoms within the services often suppressed whatever intelligence assessments were made. The government had no tradition of assessing the intentions, as distinguished from capabilities, of other countries. Those officials who did look at the question of Japanese intentions decided that Japan would never attack, because to do so would be irrational. Yet what might seem irrational to one country may seem perfectly logical to another country that has different goals, values, and traditions. Finally, many in the government looked with disdain on Japanese capabilities. As one admiral said after the attack, "I never thought those little yellow sons of bitches could pull off such an attack so far from home." An alert was finally sent at the very last minute on the morning of December 7th, but it did not reach its destination before the attack. The Army officer given the job of notifying the command at Pearl Harbor sent the message by Western Union instead of through Navy channels, when he found the Army's circuits to Hawaii were down. But this was just the last in a series of bungles. The result was the Japanese sank 5 of the Navy's 8 battleships based at Pearl Harbor, damaged 200 of the 300 aircraft based there, and killed 2,330 servicemen and 100 civilians, bringing the U.S. into World War II. "We just didn't have an intelligence system," Dr. Ray S. Klein, who was an analyst in the Navy and Office of Strategic Services before becoming Deputy CIA Director for Intelligence, said. "Franklin Roosevelt had lots of information, but he didn't have an intelligence system to present it to him. There was plenty of information about the attack on Pearl Harbor, but it was not handled bureaucratically in a way that would alert the armed services and the White House what was going on. There was no central system at that time." These failures led indirectly to the creation of the CIA in 1947. The idea of a CIA was the brainchild of Colonel William J. Wild Bill Donovan. A New York lawyer and politician, Donovan had served heroically in World War I, commanding a battalion and winning the Medal of Honor. During World War II, he headed the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. Back in 1941, Donovan submitted a plan to President Roosevelt outlining the need for a government-wide organization that would pool and coordinate existing intelligence. Following Donovan's advice, Roosevelt created a Coordinator of Information as part of the Executive Office of the President in July 1941. After a year, the Coordinator of Information evolved into the OSS, which became the model for the CIA. During the war, OSS organized resistance movements and sabotage operations behind enemy lines. The OSS also tried unsuccessfully to centralize intelligence functions within the government through an analytical section known as Research and Analysis. At the end of the war, OSS was disbanded, and the State Department absorbed many of its functions. But again, at Donovan's urging, it was reconstituted when President Truman agreed to the creation first of the Central Intelligence Group, and then a year later, the CIA. The National Security Act of 1947 establishing the agency took effect on September 18, 1947, a birthday celebrated by the modern CIA with a family day. While Donovan never served as director of the CIA, the new agency absorbed the institutional values of the OSS, including the can-do, try-anything approach that Donovan had instilled. Both before and after Pearl Harbor, the idea of centralized intelligence drew stiff opposition from many in the War Department, who saw it as an infringement on their turf. As one general said, a central agency would be very disadvantageous, if not calamitous, from the point of view of the Pentagon. That was why it was so important to Truman that the new intelligence agency be independent and not tied to the interests of the military. When the Defense Intelligence Agency was later created in 1961 to focus more on tactical questions, it often exaggerated Soviet prowess, reflecting biases of a military that constantly sought bigger budgets. This concept of a centralized intelligence agency, one that would bring together all the available information on a subject and analyze it objectively, is embodied in the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence. With 3,000 employees, it is the CIA's smallest directorate. The directorate is the analytical side of the house, where PhDs, who could just as easily be college professors, pore over all the available information and produce estimates on what they think will be the future course of events. Eggheads, rather than spooks, the analysts openly identify themselves as CIA employees and contribute to academic publications and attend conferences in their field, just like university professors. Most of us on the estimative side had little or no knowledge of the techniques of clandestine work and were prone to scoff at the excessively tight security about operations and to sneer at the bumbling of the spooks. They were doers, not contemplators, and they approached foreign affairs from precisely the opposite vantage point, R. Jack Smith, a former deputy director for intelligence, said in his book The Unknown CIA. Also, they could point to several loose-lipped indiscretions by one or more senior estimative people that they claimed had blown operations. So there was a wall between the two sides on all operational matters. Typically, the analysts want to disseminate material obtained by the operations side, and the operations officers object because they are afraid it will expose a source. The Intelligence Directorate brings together information from all sources: satellites, human spies, intercepts of communications, the press, foreign broadcasts, trade publications, newsletters, computer bulletin boards, and scientific publications. That information, at least 80% of it from open sources, is used to prepare daily research and intelligence reports, as well as long-range analyses. In addition, the information is used by the National Intelligence Council, a component of the intelligence community that reports directly to the Director of Central Intelligence, to prepare estimates of future events that are presented to the President. While each of the agencies in the intelligence community may contribute to the estimates, the most important source of information generally is the Directorate of Intelligence. Therefore, the work of the Directorate is critical. The other directorates can do marvelous work, but it will languish if it is not presented to the President and policymakers. If the analysis is wrong, the foreign policy of the U.S. will suffer. In the early days, there were a number of failures. In Korea, despite ample evidence, the CIA did not clearly alert senior policymakers in June 1950 that North Korea was about to invade the Republic of Korea. Nor did the CIA warn that tens of thousands of communist Chinese troops, who had been infiltrating North Korea, were about to attack U.S. and United Nations troops. In September 1962, the CIA said placing ballistic missiles in Cuba would not fit into the Soviet Union's known behavior patterns, and Nikita Khrushchev would not do anything so uncharacteristic, provocative, and unrewarding. Prompted by contradictory and fragmentary eyewitness reports that such a deployment might be taking place, the estimate was produced just before photographs taken by a U-2 on October 14, 1962, showed conclusively that the Soviets were moving missiles into Cuba. This was a good example of mirror imaging, assuming that another country would think the same way America thinks. While an estimate cannot predict with absolute certainty events that have not yet taken place, they can lay out the possibilities and assign probabilities. This allows smart policymakers to ready options to cope with the most likely outcomes. Yet it is not unusual for heads of state to ignore intelligence, as Joseph Stalin did in 1941 when told that the Nazis were about to invade the Soviet Union, costing the Soviets tens of thousands of lives. The most important thing was not whether we were right or wrong about the occurrence of events, but to help the people making policy decisions by giving them background information, Edward W. Proctor, a former CIA deputy director for intelligence, said. Sometimes you give them information that is right, and they make the wrong decisions. Sometimes you give them information that is wrong, and they make the right decisions for different reasons. Sometimes you give them information that is right, and they make the right decisions. Sometimes you make a prediction on something coming up and the policymakers take an action which, in effect, makes your prediction wrong, but it was the right thing to do based on your prediction. The whole purpose is to help these people make better decisions. Another example of mirror imaging occurred in 1973, when the CIA and the rest of the U.S. government failed to warn that Egypt and Syria were about to launch major attacks on Israel in what came to be known as the Yom Kippur War. We did not predict it, period. We had seen the same thing occur several times before, including a year before, and nothing had happened, Proctor, then Deputy Director for Intelligence, said. It was a build-up of forces and threats. We did not understand what the purpose was from the Egyptians' point of view. They knew they couldn't win, but it was one way of breaking the deadlock. Probably the most well-known failure came in February 1979, when the CIA did not foresee that the Shah of Iran might be overthrown. In fact, in mid-August 1978, a CIA analyst reported to President Carter, "Iran is not in a revolutionary or even pre-revolutionary situation." In this case, the Directorate of Intelligence disregarded reports coming into the CIA from the operations officers in Iran, who were reporting growing opposition to the Shah. The analysts assumed that the Shah would crush the opposition, as he had in the past. But the Shah's bout with cancer had weakened his resolve. "We were aware the Shah had opposition," Stansfield Turner, who was Director of Central Intelligence at the time, said. "One difficulty was it was hard to appreciate that a man with the military and SAVAK, the Shah's secret police, would be toppled by people parading in the streets. When you make an intelligence forecast, you make an assumption. We thought he would use the powers he had, but he didn't." It is always easier, of course, to assume that the status quo will continue. Far less risk is involved. Without hard data on Mikhail Gorbachev's intentions, for example, anyone who predicted that Gorbachev would release the Soviet grip on Eastern Europe and allow East Germany to reunite with West Germany may well have been referred to the agency's Office of Medical Services for psychiatric consultations. Anyone who said the Soviet people would vote to change the name of Leningrad back to the original St. Petersburg would have been thought to be similarly mad. "There is almost never enough firm intelligence to support a solid, definitive statement," Smith, the former deputy director for intelligence, said. "If there were, there would be no need for an estimate. The threat would be self-evident." Unless prodded from within or without, organizations tend to become more bureaucratic as they mature and less willing to take risks. The CIA is no exception. "It takes more people to get things done, and they don't do them as well," a former CIA analyst said. "There is a concern with warm bodies, production schedules, concern with pleasing the boss and not getting out of line. A process of homogenization so strong personalities or characters get shunted aside." In those cases, the former analyst said, "the going evaluation is such and such, and the head of the office and his boss has said so. Someone says, this is 180 degrees different. In the coming days or weeks, the situation plays out and the dissident is shown to be right. Often, instead of being rewarded, he is put off to the side." It is a case, the former analyst said, of causing embarrassment by being too accurate too soon. One thread that runs through the whole story from the beginning of the CIA to the present is the gradual bureaucratization of the CIA, Russell J. Bowen, a retired analyst who continues to consult for the CIA, said. "There is a certain momentum that carried from World War II and OSS-type thinking into the early 60s. The idea was you had a job to do, and you go out and do the job, and you clean up the problems later. Now we say, if we do this job, what are all the problems we might get into? So the motivation for go, go, go is long gone." Another perennial problem is the way CIA reports are written. Often they do not state conclusions clearly enough to attract attention. Besides the president, the National Security Council is the CIA's major customer. Staffers there often complain that they find CIA estimates too balanced or boring compared with those by the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, a much smaller outfit that prepares analyses for the State Department. Since the State Department is engaged in making policy, its analysts tend to tailor their work to the specific needs of the moment. In effect, State has the inside track on what the President and his aides want to read, aides who are already burdened with too much material. You have a super editor at State who says, these are the subjects I am interested in. The Secretary of State is involved in these issues, an NSC staff member from the Reagan administration said. They, the State Department, share the same short-term interests as the NSC and White House. You have overload, the former NSC staff member said. There is a limit to what those people at the NSC can handle. So you go with what is really relevant. You get a mediocre report, but it's relevant, and you read it. If it's a super report but not relevant, it doesn't get read very much. Because of the size of its analytical side, more than 2,000 analysts, the CIA tends to have more specialists who become immersed in their subjects. Steeped in the minutiae of their field, in this instance the daily flow of events in a country, they frequently mistake back-page filler items for front-page banner headline stories, according to Smith. Moreover, they have a persistent tendency to believe that their sometimes arcane thought processes will be transparent to their readers. In contrast to President Reagan, President Bush read CIA reports avidly. In part, that has contributed to a sharpening of the CIA's writing style. One of the things that has changed for the better over the last several years is they write it more to the point, said Robert Gates when he was still Deputy Assistant to the President for National Security under Bush. The President reads the estimates and rereads them, which is a change from the past. Still, Army General H. Norman Schwarzkopf complained to Congress after the Persian Gulf War that while intelligence during the war was excellent, the analyses on the Iraqi military had been caveated, footnoted, and watered down to the point that they became useless. He thus appeared to distinguish between the hard facts provided by intelligence and the analyses that sought to draw conclusions from the facts and predict the future. Schwarzkopf did not specify whether he was referring to CIA or military analysis. William Webster encountered the same problem when confronting the question of whether economic sanctions would drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. According to an aide, he had to beat the analysts into being more precise about the effect of the sanctions. The analysts were being too vague. One said sanctions would cause belt tightening. What did that mean? Webster wanted specifics on when they would work. In 6 months? In a year? He wanted to know. If an estimate covers all bases, it will always be right, but also close to useless. Webster finally got what he wanted, a statement that the sanctions would take at least a year to have any chance of working. Webster also browbeat Dr. Fritz W. Ermarth, then chairman of the National Intelligence Council, over the use of the words probably, likely, and possible in estimates. Webster wanted to know what these words meant in terms of the percentage chance that certain events would occur. Over the years, the national estimating structure has been changed several times to try to sharpen its work. After the CIA failed to predict the North Korean invasion of the South, CIA Director Walter Bedell Smith established an Office of National Estimates to focus more attention on the process. The estimates were developed collegially, based on information presented by CIA analysts and the entire intelligence community. In the fall of 1973, Colby replaced the old board with the National Intelligence Council. I changed the board because I thought the estimates and analysis were much too generalized, Colby said. Under the new system, each of the 16 members of the board is called a National Intelligence Officer and is given responsibility for a specific issue or geographic area. The idea was to make each officer accountable for his or her area, rather than to develop estimates by consensus of the board members. There is a National Intelligence Officer for warning, one for nuclear proliferation, one for strategic weapons, and then one for each area of the world, such as Latin America and the Near East and South Asia. The NIO for warning, for example, has the primary responsibility for sounding the alarm if a military attack is about to take place. Generally, the NIO officers are veteran CIA officers, former high-ranking State Department officials, or former generals or admirals, people with enough standing to buck the bureaucracy. Typically, they serve for 2-year terms to guarantee that the position will constantly be replenished with new blood. They are supposed to spend more time with policymakers than did the old members of the Office of National Estimates. In drawing up estimates, the NIOs rely on their own staffs and on analysis presented by the Directorate of Intelligence. The final draft of a national intelligence estimate is written by the appropriate NIO. Changes may be made all the way along the line up to the president. The chairman of the council, the DCI, and other agencies within the intelligence community can and do add their views. The council itself reports through its chairman directly to the director of Central Intelligence, who presents estimates to the president representing the collective judgment of the dozen agencies that make up the intelligence community. In some cases, CIA directors have disagreed with their own estimates, as John A. McCone did when he took issue with the agency's judgments on the meaning of Soviet activity in Cuba before the Cuban Missile Crisis. McCone met with President Kennedy and said, "Something new and different was going on in Cuba." He flatly said the Soviets were introducing offensive missiles on the island. McCone had nothing to go on except his own intuition about Khrushchev. After the CIA issued its estimate discounting the buildup, he cabled the agency while on his one-month honeymoon in Europe, urging a reassessment. By then, events had shown that McCone was right. William Casey and Stansfield Turner also tended to act as analysts and offer their own opinions, which sometimes differed with what the CIA was saying. If a DCI disagrees with all or part of an estimate, he may choose to submit it anyway and signify his disagreement on the document or in a note attached to it, or he may reject it outright. Individual agencies within the intelligence community often disagree with all or part of the estimates. Their dissent is carried in the document also. Besides national intelligence estimates, which look at fundamental issues and often take a year to complete, the Council issues special national intelligence estimates, which are generally more urgent and completed in a matter of days or weeks, as well as a variety of memos that may be completed within a few days in response to particular concerns. In addition, the analysts prepare hundreds of additional reports on everything from wheat harvests to the political standing of world leaders. In 1976, the CIA experimented with creating competing teams for developing national estimates on Soviet intentions and capabilities. In all, the CIA had six teams look at three different questions. The A teams represented the intelligence community, while the B teams were composed of a panel of outside experts. In one area, Soviet strategic intentions, the B team shone. It said the Soviet Union was seeking a first strike capability in the 1970s, while the A team discounted the possibility. Recent Soviet statements have validated the B team's judgment. But not all of the B teams were superior, and the CIA abandoned the system. In effect, it was like letting an outside group submit competing editorials for publication in a newspaper. If the editorials did not represent the opinion of the newspaper, their value was diminished. In 1980, Stansfield Turner gave the chairman of the National Intelligence Council greater authority over the individual officers to better supervise their work. In the view of Dr. Ford, a distinguished expert on estimating, this system has worked better than any previous one. With the exception of the failure of the CIA to predict sharply worsening economic conditions in the Soviet Union, there have been no significant intelligence failures since then. While the CIA reported on growing destabilization within the Eastern Bloc, it would have been impossible to predict that Gorbachev would relinquish the Soviet grip on Eastern Europe before he himself had made that decision. Despite the occasional failures, the CIA, as the representative of the intelligence community, has registered a more than respectable batting average over the years. Senator Frank Church, one of the CIA's severest critics, acknowledged in 1975 when he became the first chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, "In the last 25 years, no important new Soviet weapons system, from their H-bomb to their most recent missiles, has appeared which had not been heralded in advance by NIEs, National Intelligence Estimates." Among other events, the CIA predicted that the Soviets would launch an Earth satellite before the U.S., that the Chinese communists would detonate an atomic bomb, and that the Soviets would produce a ballistic missile. The agency predicted the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, the India-Pakistan War, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Back in 1960, despite claims by James Angleton and his supporters that the split was a fraud, the CIA alerted the U.S. government to the causes and dimensions of the rift between the Soviet Union and Communist China. Before the U-2 and imaging satellites, the CIA tended to overestimate Soviet progress in weapons development, but not nearly as much as did the military services. Yet overestimates of military strength are always preferable to underestimates. From the mid-1960s to the early 1970s, the CIA tended to underestimate the extent of the Soviet buildup, but not by enough to make an appreciable difference. During the Vietnam War, the CIA repeatedly asserted that the enemy was stronger than believed within the U.S. government and that the South Vietnamese government was weaker. The agency stated that other countries would not fall to communism if the North overran the South. For example, on June 11, 1964, in answer to whether the defeat of the South Vietnamese would lead to the feared domino effect, CIA Director John A. McCone wrote to McGeorge Bundy, Special Assistant to President Johnson for National Security Affairs, "We do not believe that the loss of South Vietnam and Laos would be followed by the rapid successive communization of the other states of the Far East." On May 12, 1967, in a report entitled "The Current Status of Morale in North Vietnam," the CIA said, "With only a few exceptions, recent reports suggest a continued willingness on the part of the populace to abide by Hanoi's policy on the war." The report added that the mood is "one of resolute stoicism with a considerable reservoir of endurance still untapped." I remember once, in the Lyndon Johnson period, being asked by McGeorge Bundy to have the CIA prepare an objective analysis of the results of the U.S. Air Force bombing of North Vietnam. Dr. Ray S. Klein, then the CIA's Deputy Director for Intelligence, said in his book, The CIA Under Reagan, Bush, and Casey. He said, "Everyone agrees your analysts are the only honest guys in town, and we need to know the truth." A small group of analysts went to work making such evaluations. Over a period of time, their work demonstrated that little progress was being made in slowing down the North Vietnamese infiltration of the South. The CIA was the bearer of bad tidings throughout the Vietnam War, and was not very happily received by any of the policymakers who tried to make the Vietnam intervention work. Ironically, the CIA, in classified reports, was saying exactly what the anti-war demonstrators were saying on the streets of Washington. The analysts gnashed their teeth as President Johnson turned a deaf ear to their warnings, preferring, like President Nixon after him, to believe that the Soviet Union or communists were behind the anti-war sentiment. "The trouble was the Johnson and Nixon administrations did not really listen to intelligence," said Thomas Polgar, who was CIA station chief in Vietnam from 1972 to 1975. "They had their own policies and preconceptions." "Johnson only wanted to hear the good points about Vietnam," said R. Jack Smith, who was deputy director for intelligence at the end of the Johnson administration. By and large, the CIA stuck to its guns and continued to report unfavorable prognoses. But when William Casey became director of Central Intelligence in 1981, the CIA faced a different problem. What happens when the director of Central Intelligence himself has a political agenda?